The question which you should ask everybody in the world should know this, particularly medical doctors and anybody who calls himself a scientist, which is a very simple question of how does a virologist know there is a new virus and prove that it causes disease? Right? If this whole thing is based on a virus and you don't know how to answer that question, which I can literally guarantee, and I hope people check me on this, go to your family doctor and ask them that question, and they won't know. And so if you don't know the answer to this question, and you're going to know, A, how it should be done and how it is done, because once you know the answer to that question, you will never believe again that viruses cause any disease. All you have to know, it takes a half an hour, I hope, to answer that question. Then you will know forevermore what the story is, and you will know what your medical doctor doesn't know. Got it? Okay, for those who say, oh, Tom, what difference does it make what's causing this? It makes a lot of difference, because if you treat scurvy as a contagious illness and quarantine people, that's a lot worse than giving them a lemon.
This is such an important study that I want to give a little bit of context so that it becomes clear just how important this study actually is. So the study in the background is, I'm sure most, if not all of you already know the name Stefan Lenke. He was a biology graduate student and ended up discovering a virus living in a sea algae in the ocean. It was the first free living virus that was discovered in the ocean. And then he started looking more and more into viruses. And what he found shocked him, and he didn't say anything for a while. And then he realized that what he had discovered was actually correct. Once he became sure of that, he was able to go public with it, which is that viruses, most of them actually don't even exist, and they're not pathogens. The next important thing that happened with him is he was instrumental in offering a 100,000 euro prize for anybody who could demonstrate the existence of a measles virus in the German court system. And it was important that it was in the German court system because they have stricter rules of scientific inquiry, I think, than any other court system in the world. And so he offered that prize and somebody took him up on it. They won in a lower court, which I think he knew was going to happen because they don't have such strict rules. And then the case actually went to the German Supreme Court, and they appointed a scientific master, and they went through the science of the case. And the ruling was that there was no evidence that this measles virus actually exists. And we're not even talking about whether the measles virus causes measles. We're talking about whether it actually exists. So the ruling was there was no evidence of that. And then he became kind of famous or maybe infamous because of that. And he's continued to look into virology and life and biology and what went wrong. And he was the one who actually told me about Harold Hillman. And he's sort of kept in touch with this whole thing. And then we come to the current situation of what Stefan calls the corona crisis. And so Stefan commissioned a study with a apparently well-known, very professional tissue culture, cell culture, or so-called viral culture expert, I believe, in Switzerland, and he supervised the study, and that's what we're going to talk about today.
Stefan Lanka performed control experiments. What results do you think he got? The same as John Enders. Exactly the same cytopathic effect occurred in cell culture without any infectious material added, but with the same conditions such as high doses of antibiotics and decreased nutrition. Let's take a closer look at these experiments. So here are the images of the control experiments that Stefan Lanka did, and now I will explain everything to you. As you can see, four cell lines are used here. The very first line serves as a control. The other three are the lines with which the experiment is being carried out. Here at the top, we can see what these three experimental cell lines looked like before the start of the experiment. And as you can see, they look very healthy. So let's move on to the top control group. Here it says, control number one, CM, is a culture medium that is complete normal cell nutrition and one dose of ABAM, which means antibiotics, antimycotics. To be specific, the drug called amphotericin is used here because it was the drug that was used in all SARS-CoV-2 isolation studies. Further, it says here, 1 day stress and 5 days after stress. Stress refers to a change in the nutrient medium. As you can see, the cell line that from the very first day received good nutrition and a small dose of antibiotics remained healthy on the fifth day of the experiment. We do not observe any cytopathic effect or cell death. Let's move on to the next group. What we are seeing now is closer to what virologists are doing in their experiments, but not completely. A different kind of culture medium is used here, DMEM, which stands for Delbecco's Modified Eagle's Medium. This medium differs from the standard culture medium because it has reduced nutrient concentrations. Then, 10% FCS is used, which is fetal calf serum. It is used to add extra nutrition because DMEM is not enough for cells to survive. And so far, the same dose of amphotericin is used. We see that these changes in the nutrient medium led to serious changes in the cell culture. It is not as healthy as the first one. We see that the cells have lost their shape. They are not as uniform as in the first picture. If we look at the third image, we see exactly what virologists are doing with cell cultures. Here, the concentration of nutrients was further decreased, approximately in half. Then the concentration of fetal calf serum was reduced from 10% to 1%. In addition, the dose of antibiotics was increased from 1 to 3. And here we can see very clearly how cells degrade and break down. They were healthy, but a few days after changing the nutrient medium and using such a high dose of amphotericin, they begin to look abnormal. And after 5 days, we observe a serious cytopathic effect. And all this happens without the use of any infectious material, only due to the toxic conditions in which these cells were placed. The last group was used for further control experiments for the so-called genomic sequencing, during which virologists, of course, also do not conduct any control experiments. But Stefan Lanka will do it for them and show that from this cell culture, in which there is no virus at all, using their methods, you can sequence the genome of SARS-CoV-2 virus, Ebola virus, measles virus, and any virus you want. I will talk about these experiments later when they are finished. We will not discuss this now, but as you can see, a resource of RNA was added to this culture. This RNA is obtained from yeast, but not from ordinary yeast, but from a matrix substance. It was added there because when virologists add lung fluid from a patient to a cell culture, they introduce a large amount of nucleic acids. Therefore, with the help of RNA from yeast, they tried to mimic the patient's sputum, which is rich in such molecules. Yeast-derived RNA is completely neutral. It is not pathogenic in any way, but here you can see that its presence causes an even greater cytopathic effect, although it is not related to any pathogen. Friends, this experiment refutes all the theory on which virology is built. The theory that viruses exist and cause disease has now been completely disproved. These experiments show that what virologists call evidence of the presence of a virus in a tissue sample are just consequences caused by the very conditions of the experiment in the laboratory, and they are never caused by the presence of a non-existent virus.
The question of the day should be, unfortunately it isn't, but how does a virologist know that a virus exists, or maybe a new virus exists? And then the second part of the question is, once they find this new virus and show that it exists, how do they demonstrate that this new virus causes such and such a disease? And I would contend that if you know the answer to that question, you will never believe in pathogenic viruses again. Pathogenic means disease-causing viruses. If you don't know the answer to that question, you will be confused and waffle, and sometimes you may think it does exist, and sometimes you may think it doesn't, but you really will not feel that you're on firm ground. That's why I keep pushing that question. And I also would say that there's two-part answer to that. There's the part of how a virologist should prove the existence of a virus and show that it causes disease. And then the second part is how they actually do. So that's what we're going to be going over, and that's what Stefan's study interfaces with that question. So just to rush through this a little bit, the other thing I would say is I would strongly encourage those of you who have, say, family doctors or connections with other medical doctors or medical professionals, that you ask them this question, at least after today. And I just want to remind you that the answer to this, you're looking for the steps, similar to how if you asked a baker, how do you make a cake? They wouldn't say, well, you go to the cake store and buy a cake. They would say you mix a certain amount of flour with water, and then you do this, and then you knead it or don't knead it, or put in baking soda and you put in this much, and then you end up with a cake. You bake it at 325 or whatever it is. I'm talking about the actual steps. And you will be shocked that my guess is that not one person, not one medical professional that you will encounter will actually know the answer to this question, which should be the question that everybody knows. So the first answer that many people, if not most people, I would say the vast majority of lay people and most of the medical professionals give, which again, I've gone over, is, well, they say that a lot of people got sick in the same place, so it must be a virus. Or a lot of people got sick here and then it spread to this place, so it must be a virus. Or there was nobody who was sick in this prison and then there was somebody who tested positive and then somebody went there and then they got sick, or a bunch of people got sick, so it must be a virus. Or my Aunt Bessie went to church and there was somebody who tested positive there and then she got sick, and so that must be a virus. And as I've said over and over again, these are epidemiological observations, and the only role for epidemiological observations is to generate hypotheses that can then be tested. And there is no medical professional or virologist who thinks that any of these observations prove the existence of a virus. That would be naive and unscientific to think that, and so please do not think that. All they tell you is you should look and see if there's anything that's being passed between people. And I agree that should have been looked into. Okay, the next thing they say, and now we're talking they, meaning some laymen and most medical professionals, is you take a bunch of people who are sick, presumably sick in the same way, and then you look through some of their some bodily fluid, like bronchial alveolar lavage, that just means lung fluid, or sputum, or snot, or blood, or urine, or feces, or cerebrospinal fluid, or any other fluid you choose, and you should see hundreds, thousands, maybe millions of copies of a particle, because remember, we're looking for a particle, not a feeling or a thought. And this particle has a protein coat and a piece of genetic material, either RNA or DNA, inside. So we should see identical particles, and they should have the same size, the same shape, the same morphology. And then you should, there should be essentially no other kinds of particles from that fluid. And that tells you if every 100 of those people with the same symptoms, that doesn't prove that it's causing the disease, right? But it proves that there is an identical particle coming from people with identical symptoms, and it's the size, shape, morphology, and genetic characteristics of a virus. Now, the next thing I'll say is doing that, and I've gone through the steps. You macerate, filter, centrifuge, look at it under an electron microscope. This has been done hundreds of times for things that are the same size, shape, and composition of viruses. As soon as we invented the electron microscope in the 30s, we could see bacteriophages, which come from bacterial cultures which are dying. And we could find them in this way, macerate, that means put it in a blender, filter it, centrifuge it, you get a band, you suck the band out, you see thousands of identical particles. Those were called bacteriophages, or particles that eat bacteria, although now we know they don't actually eat bacteria, they come from the bacteria. Stefan saw them, so-called giant viruses living in the ocean, in the sea algae. And we've also, I was just given a paper yesterday, which is a number of papers like this. We can do this with exosomes, which are particles that are generated by our own tissue when we're sick or stressed, that are the same size, shape, morphology, and composition of a virus. And we have isolated them from tissues of people, sick or otherwise. It's a very easy, simple thing that any virologist could do. So this is not a technical problem. Now, I can tell you that there is no disagreement with what I'm about to say, because as I've said a few weeks ago, I had a conversation because Andy Kaufman and I were asked to present in front of a group, and they invited a fellow who was introduced to us as a former senior virologist in Wuhan for the Chinese Center for Disease Control and an expert in laboratory virology at Yale University. And he agreed with the following statement. There is not one reported case in the medical literature where any such identical particle has been found in any fluid of any sick person. Not once. We have looked for a year. There is not a reported case of that. And nobody disagrees with that. When we asked him, has this ever been done? He said, that is not possible. Why? Because you first have to concentrate. And so it was actually Andy who asked him, if you took 100 people with COVID, who have been diagnosed with COVID, and you mixed their sputum together, would that be enough to find the virus in their sputum? And he said, no. If you mixed 1,000 people and took their sputum, all who had COVID, mixed it together, would there then be enough to find the virus? And he said, no. And then we asked him, what about 10,000 people? And he said, no. That is simply not the way that any virologist finds a virus. As shocking as that is to hear, it's never been done and it cannot be done. And it's not for technical reasons. So the question then is how does a virologist, so that's the answer to how they should do it. They should look through the fluid, the bronchial fluid or snot or blood or somewhere, macerate it, filter it, centrifuge it, take the virus out, look at it under an electron microscope, characterize the genome, and then take that purified virus and spray that onto an animal in the usual way that you think the virus is passed. And that will prove that the virus exists and that it causes disease, period. That's how it should be done. That process has never been done. So now we get to the next step. How do they say, because I'm just going to take a wild guess here, there's probably 10,000 papers in the medical literature since 1954 with the title isolation of such and such a virus, including I've seen maybe 30 of them about the SARS-CoV-2 virus. So why are they saying this? Or on what justification? And here is the important point. Here is the way they do it. They take one person, now I'm talking particularly about a study in done out of Australia, which was the first, quote, isolation of SARS-CoV-2 outside of China that I know of. So they took one person who was sick. They took some bronchial alveolar lavage fluid, meaning they did a bronchoscopy and sucked out some of the fluid. And then they washed it in a saline buffered solution to get rid of some of the debris. And then they filtered it and they took the resultant liquid. Now, nobody would say, no virologist, no logical, sane, rational person would say that that is purified virus. That's fluid taken from a sick person with proteins, DNA, RNA, maybe viruses, and maybe toxins, and whatever else is coming out that's soluble in the lungs of a sick person. Okay, that's the first step. Now, this is called their inoculant. They then took that, and remember, we're looking for a protein coat with a genetic interior piece of genetic material in the inside. They then mixed that with fetal bovine serum, 10%, and mixed it with gentamicin and amphotericin, two kidney nephrotoxic antibiotics, antifungals. Then they withdrew the nutrients from the medium and inoculated that on monkey kidney cells, otherwise known as Vero cells. Now, here is the part that every virologist agrees on. The definition of the existence of the virus is when the Vero cells break down in a characteristic way called a cytopathic effect, otherwise known as CPE. That CPE, that cytopathic effect, is considered proof of the existence of the virus and proof that the virus has been isolated, period. That is the definition. Now, then the Vero cells break down because of this cytopathic effect, and then they do an electron microscope of the resulting breakdown products of this so-called viral culture. That process I just described is called a viral culture. And they see little particles of many, many, many different sizes and shape. Some are bullet-shaped, some are rod-shaped, some are cocci circular-shaped, and some have little dots in them. And if you put trypsin, which digests the coating, some of them look like they have spikes. And then you say, you pick out one and you say, that is the virus we're looking for. And that is how they identify characterize and prove the existence of the virus. That should be very clear. They are very clear on that. There is no other way to prove the existence of the virus. Then after they do that, they do genetic analysis, which I won't get into, on the resulting brew from the breakdown products of the fetal bovine serum, the vero cells, and whatever was in the inoculant, and the genomycin, and the amphotericin, and the nutrient media. So they do a genetic analysis on that, and then they do a PCR test on that resulting brew, or they take segments that they get in that genetic analysis, and those become the primer sequences for the PCR test. So the question of the hour, which we went into before when I described the Enders paper. So this process called the viral culture started with John Franklin Enders in 1954, when he, quote, rescued virology because they had spent 20 years and couldn't find any pathogenic viruses. And so he said, I have a new way to find these pathogenic viruses. And he did exactly what I just said. And then he said the monkey kidney cells broke down. That proves the existence of a virus. Now, interestingly, Enders at the time did a kind of control. So in his paper, he says, I did the exact same procedure, although he doesn't actually outline the procedure that he did for the control. So we don't really know it was the exact same, but let's say it was. The only difference is he didn't start with anything from any person with measles. So remember, the virus supposedly came from the bronchial lavage fluid of the patient who's sick. In Enders' case, he took some fluid from somebody, a child with measles, and he inoculated that, and that was the source of the virus. And then he did the entire experiment, but he didn't put anything from anybody with measles. And he says in the paper, the breakdown product that I got was indistinguishable one from the other. And then he put some stains in and thought he could see some differences, but he wasn't sure about that. And basically said, you know, somebody should check this at some point because I'm not sure that what we're seeing here is a result of a virus from measles or the procedure that we're doing, calling it a viral culture. And he put a quote in his paper from a guy named Ruckel who said, you know, we don't really know whether these particles that we're seeing are from the vero cells or from the child with measles. Now, shockingly, nobody has really repeated that study with that control until last month. So what Stefan did was hire a viral culture laboratory, and he did the following. He grew a tissue culture. In other words, cells, he grew them with normal medium and normal 10% bovine fetal serum. The reason they put bovine fetal serum is it helps feed the cultures, the cells, so that they grow. Then he put them in normal nutrient medium. And so I can't show this right now, but you see a two series of boxes. And then they show the results in the top. The top box is what happens at day one. There's four of them. The second line of boxes is what happens on day five. So the first step is normal cells grown with 10% fetal bovine serum, normal nutrients, and very small amount of antibiotics just to get the culture used to being exposed to antibiotics. No cytopathic effect on day one, no cytopathic effect on day five. So that's, in other words, a normal culture. Then he changes the culture, and so he does step two. Same culture, growing with 10% fetal bovine serum. The first one, I think he didn't add antibiotics. The second one, he added antibiotics in a very small amount. So normal nutrient medium, normal fetal bovine serum, 10%. On culture cells with a small amount of antibiotic, day one, day five, control, same control, adding a small amount of antibiotics, no cytopathic effect. And I know you can't see it. Then he changes the culture medium and puts a reduced nutrient medium. Now, every study that I've ever read, when they do these experiments, they say they grew the culture in minimal nutrient medium. In other words, they take away the nutrients from the culture. They reduce the fetal bovine serum, which provides the growth factors for the growth of the culture, from 10% here to 1% here. And then they add three times the number of antibiotics as the control, which is the exact same amount of antibiotics in every viral culture that I've ever seen. Some exceptions, they sometimes use two times, sometimes two and a half, but it's anywhere between two and three. And that's to essentially, they say, keep bacteria and fungus from growing, even though they already filtered them out. Again, so all they did was change the nutrient medium, reduce the fetal serum, add antibiotics, exactly like they did in the Australian study. There was no addition of any fluid, any particles, any viruses, anything from any sick person. And as you can sort of see, but not see, they got the characteristic cytopathic effect that proves the existence of a virus. Now think about that. It proved the existence of a virus because under the influence of withdrawing the nutrients, withdrawing the fetal bovine serum, and adding the normal dose that they use of antibiotics, you got the very thing, the CPE, that is used to prove the existence of the virus. Yet, there was no virus added to this sample, this experiment. There was no fluid from any sick person added to the sample. Proving that the cytopathic effect came from the way they did the culture, not from any virus. And then the fourth column, day one, day five, is the same thing as they did in the step three, which is reduce the nutrients, reduce the fetal bovine serum from 10% to 1%, add antibiotics. But this time they added pure RNA from yeast. No virus. No DNA, just a pure stock of wide variety of RNA pieces derived from a simple yeast. No virus, no fluid from any sick person. And they got the exact same CPE breakdown of the tissue culture cells as they got in step three. The reason for doing this addition of the RNA is that in the next part of the experiment, which isn't finished, they will then show that because of the addition of RNA, no virus, they will prove that SARS-CoV-2 is in this final mix, even though nothing from anybody with COVID or any other sick person or any other virus was introduced. All of this particles all of this genetic material is coming from either the fetal bovine serum, the culture cells, or the yeast RNA, no virus added, yet they will show that you can find SARS-CoV-2, measles virus, polio virus, or any other RNA virus you want, even though they are clearly not there. It's just a function of how they do alignment of the genome. And so that is the answer to how they do find it. And I think if anybody really understood what I would say, what I just said, they would see that the whole foundation of virology, which is this viral culture producing the effect called CPE, cytopathic effect, is basically a house of cards. From your article in March, why do virologists skip the first step of examining the fluid taken from sick people under an electron microscope? What reason do they give? The reason that the virologist from China gave to us is there's not enough virus to find. The other reason I've heard is viruses are obligate intracellular parasites. Therefore, they don't come out of the cell. Therefore, you can't find them out of the cell. Now, again, with the first one, there's not enough virus to find. We asked him if you put 100,000 people, well, we asked him 10,000. We asked him 100,000, but he wouldn't answer that. We asked him 10,000, and he said, no, there's not enough virus to find. You have to concentrate the virus. Concentration of the virus means put it through a culture like I just described, which I would submit is scientific fraud. The answer that it's only intracellular inside the cell, because then I asked him, well, how does it get from one person to another? And they said, well, it buds out of the cell. So you see pictures of these little particles, quote, budding out of cells. But you don't know whether, first of all, it's just a piece of the entire field. And if you looked at another part of the field, you would see completely different particles. And of course, they're not budding off of the cell. The cells are breaking down, and some of these particles are still apparently stuck to the walls of the tissue. So the answer, it never gets out of the cell. So how does it get from one person to another? Then they say it gets out of the cell. And I say, why don't you catch it then? And they stop answering then. So there's a question of, do I think most virologists know this? I think it's a process of what I would call self-fooling, and that they don't want to go back and do rigorous controls and proper scientific experiments because I think they know what they would find. Now, Stefan and Andy and I reproduced, Stefan was a virologist and he reproduced this study. We helped support and fund it. And we did the whole thing all over again. We took cells and we grew them and they were fine. And then we added calf serum and they were fine. And then we added a little bit of antibiotics and they were fine. And then we took away the nutrients, exactly like all of the isolation experiments. And then we added the same antibiotics that they add to all the isolation experiments. And the tissue broke down, proving that it was a virus. But there was no virus anywhere in there. There was just normal tissue, fetal calf serum, antibiotics, take away the nutrients, breaks down. That is the proof the virus exists. It's called a cytopathic effect, means cell killing. If they see the cells die, they say that proves it's a virus. And we've proved that the cell killing comes because of we starved and poisoned the tissue. There's no virus involved at all. And there we go. That's the whole story right there. And so every analysis, every genome, every variant is based on this breakdown of the tissue, which there's no virus. And then, by the way, so we didn't add a virus.
Right.
And then we added some RNA from yeast. And then we sequenced the entire SARS-CoV-2 genome, which was never in there because there was nothing from anybody with COVID or anything. So we literally sequenced the genome just by adding RNA from yeast, which has no virus in it, proving that the sequencing of the genome is a complete fraud. The other thing is I am in possession of 12 peer-reviewed, very good studies where they looked at people who had, quote, viral infections, and they made them cough on other people and sneeze on them and stuff their snot up their other person's nose. And in thousands of cases, nobody got sick. There is not one contagion study showing the transmission of any, quote, viral disease from anybody in that way.
And when you talk about a contagion, what are you referring to?
I'm talking about one person making another person sick because of a, quote, microorganism like a virus.
Does that include things like bacteria?
It does, but let's not get into bacteria right now.
Okay, so just viruses. Okay, right.
Yeah, it does include bacteria. Nobody has isolated a bacteria and then made another person sick. That has never happened, at least in the published literature in the world that I've seen. And I've looked, believe me. I wouldn't say that if I didn't know that was true. Okay, so then, and obviously, you know, virologists have to do something to show the virus, right? Not just read the newspaper and say a lot of people got sick, you know, so that means it's a virus. So here's the thing. And when you ask medical doctors, this is what they say. So you take a person who's sick, or 100 people, or 1,000 people, right? They all have the same symptoms, like measles, chicken pox, or supposedly COVID, or mumps, or the flu, or any, quote, viral disease. And you look through any biological fluid they have, blood, urine, feces, snot, eye fluid, tonsils, any fluid. And you have to really listen to this. There is not one published study in the world medical literature of any pathogenic, that is disease-causing virus, being found in any biological fluid from any sick person, ever.
None.
Now, you may disagree or not disagree with that, but let me tell you the people who agree with this statement, what I just made. There is not one published study of any virus that supposedly causes disease being found in any fluid of any sick person. So in writing now, 120 different health authorities like the CDC and the FDA and the NIH and South African Ministry of Health, they have all been asked, do you have any published paper of SARS-CoV-2 or any pathogenic virus being found in the bodily fluid of any sick person? They said no. No. We asked the authors of the six leading papers that were the six original papers saying that SARS-CoV-2 was that's the name of the virus, is the cause of COVID, that's the disease. And the papers were titled The Isolation and Characterization of SARS-CoV-2. Isolation means they found the virus. And we asked them, did you find the virus in the bodily fluid of any sick person? And they all said, no, we did not attempt to do that. Now, here's another person. So the health authority said I'm right. the authors of the 6 leading papers on SARS-CoV-2 said I was right. And then I was asked to give a talk about what I usually say to a group of worldwide activists, lawyers, you know, the intelligentsia of the freedom movement, right? And they're not happy with what I'm saying. So they invited a couple virologists, including a guy, a Chinese guy who was 20 years senior virologist at the Wuhan Center for Disease Control Institute of Virology, and then 20 years at Yale University senior pathologist and head of their virology laboratory, right? 40 years, you would think this guy knows something about virology, right? So he was there to say, Tom is crazy. So I did my thing and I said, is there any published case of a SARS-CoV-2 being found in any person, any fluid of any person who's sick with COVID? Answer, no. Why not? There's not enough virus to see. So I was with Andy then, and Andy had the presence of mind to say, what about if you mixed 10 people's sputum together, would there then be enough virus to see? He said, no.
Gee.
What about 100 people? You mixed 100 people, all who you say have COVID. You look through their fluid. Would there then be enough virus to see? He said, no. What about 1,000 people? He said, no. What about 10,000 people? He said, quote, there's not enough virus to see. And then he wouldn't answer anymore. So anybody who thinks that you can find a virus in any fluid of any sick person is just clearly and absolutely mistaken, because that's never been done. Now, the question then, that's how you should do it. You get a bunch of people sick. We have the very specific technique. This is not a technical problem. You take the sputum, you macerate it, like put it in a blender, you filter it, centrifuge it, you get a band, you suck the band out. The only thing that's in the band is these particles, the size and consistency of a virus. They have a protein coat. They have genetic interior. You characterize it, and that is called isolation and finding the virus. That has never been done. So how do they do it? Why are there 2,000 to 10,000 papers called the isolation of the measles virus, the mumps virus, chickenpox, SARS-CoV-2, MERS,
HIV.
Zika, HIV. What did they do? Why are they writing a paper saying they found the virus? Here's what they did. And this started in 1954 when they realized they couldn't find the virus in any fluid of any sick person. So a guy named John Enders, he took snot from somebody with measles. He filtered it, which is not isolation, right? It's like making coffee. You grind it, filter it, and you have coffee, which has lots of things in it. Then he put that with milk, and then he mixed that with horse serum, bovine embryonic fluid, and fetal calf serum. And then he spread that on monkey kidney cells. And then nothing happened. And then he took away the nutrients from the cells that were growing. He starved them. And nothing happened. And then he added antibiotics, which are specifically toxic to kidney cells. And then the kidney cells broke down into a million pieces. And he said, that proves there was a virus. And the particles that it broke down in, he said, those are the measles virus. Now, here's what's interesting. He did the same experiment with the horse serum, calf serum, starved it, you know, antibiotics, milk, etc. But the second time, he didn't add anything from anybody with measles. Right? Mm. You with me?
Yeah.
And you know what happened? it broke down in exactly the same way. He said, quote, the results were indistinguishable, which means that it had nothing to do with measles person because there was nothing from the measles person in there. It was because he poisoned and starved the monkey kidney cells or the horse serum or something, broke down and when tissue dies, it forms these little particles, which we've known about for 80 years, which look like what are called viruses. But they're just, it's like the analogy I gave was, if you go looking for pieces of paper outside your house and you don't find any, and then you come back a week later and there's two houses that are blown to smithereens, and there's all these paper bits all over the lawn, right? You say, I know what happened. The paper got into the house, reproduced itself, blew up the house, and that's why you have millions of bits of paper. And then a little boy on a bicycle comes by and says, hey, mister, somebody put dynamite in the house and blew up the house.
Yeah.
These are not coming from the outside. So you have to stick with the fact first that there is no pathogenic virus that has ever been found in any sick person. What's happening here in the days of Koch and Pasteur and those people, they said all the organisms in us came from the outside, yeah, and they're poison. Now, then there was a transition. So some are from the outside and are make you sick, and some are from the inside, right? The reality, they're all from the inside. All of the so-called viruses, it's a misconception. It's just the breakdown of your tissue. I used to say before COVID, there's three things that make you sick. One, you have an injury, like you fall off a horse, right?
Yes.
That's different. So everybody knows about that.
Right.
Number two, you starve the person. Now, there's creative ways of starving people, like you can not give them vitamin C and then they get scurvy, or B3 or whatever it is, and then you get beriberi or pellagra, I can't remember which one. Or you could starve people of love or affection or security.
Or lack of sleep.
Or sleep, or there's lots of interesting and creative ways of starving a human being. And then you make them sick. Or you can poison them. And we also have creative ways of poisoning people. Glyphosate, EMFs, arsenic, mercury, inject aluminum. You know, you could go on and on.
Vaccines.
That's why people get sick. Now, I've added a fourth since COVID, which I actually think is the worst of all. I didn't so much appreciate this. And I call it delusional thinking. Because thinking nonsense is bad for your health. So those are the four ways. So if you scare the shit out of somebody, and you know, that's poisoning them, right? And you can go through the physiology and the hormones and all that, but you everybody knows, if you don't feed somebody, if you feed them only, you know, in poo-poo, that the Swazi, that then they get sick because you need other things. If you intoxicate them with, you know, cheap beer all day long, they get sick. If you don't let children go outside, they get sick. If you put a mask over your face so you're breathing in your own exhaust, that's a poison. So you get sick. And some of them are common.
Yes.
And then you call that measles. That's like common to all children.
Or chickenpox.
Here's the thing. Yeah. Here's the thing. Every study that's ever been done on measles and chickenpox says definitively, children who get measles and chickenpox have less disease for the rest of their life. Less cancer, less diabetes, less heart disease, less arthritis. And if you don't go through it, you end up with more tendency to asthma, eczema, cancer, etc. So this is not actually a disease. It's a cleansing maturation process. It's like a snake shedding its skin. Oh. You say, okay, snake, you know, when you're shedding your skin, a wombat might come and eat you. So we're going to stop you from shedding your skin. And then the snake has a tight skin and it can't live. And of course, there's some risk, you know.
Yes.
But not very much with measles or chickenpox. I mean, essentially none. And so we've turned that maturation step into a disease process, and then we make everybody sick for life. Now, here's the thing. Then the next question is, well, yeah, but my child got chickenpox from somebody else.
Yes, or flu.
Yeah, or flu. But first of all, you know, if you put wallpaper that's impregnated with arsenic in your house, you will see a lot of people get sick. You know, they used to make art wallpaper with arsenic in it, and millions of them. And is that a virus when all the children get sick? If you spray glyphosate in somebody's house and they all get sick, is that a virus? So just because people get sick in the same time, you know, if you go to a restaurant and you eat bad chicken and you get food poisoning, is that a virus? There's a poison. Spanish flu wasn't contagious. Boston Health Department did a study. They took 100 and some people with the Spanish flu, one of the deadliest viral infections so-called ever. They bribed a bunch of prisoners and said they'd let them out, and they made them cough in their face and took snot and stuff it up their nose. And they said not one got sick. And then, interestingly, they said, well, that's because we didn't use aggressive enough techniques to transfer the infection. 150 or so people, not one got sick. And even though they took mucus when they were actively sick and withdrew it and shot it up the prisoner's nose. And I remember first time I read it, I thought, so what more aggressive techniques were they talking about? Like, what about a lung transplant? Like, maybe that would get them sick. The problem is, how do you know it's the virus and not the fact that you took somebody's lung out and put it in another person? Right? This is, and you know, we went through all these black deaths, and some of them, you know, were caused by rats, but turns out they didn't have any rats. It's all just make believe. There is no personal clinical evidence for the existence of a virus. There may be personal experience for the transmissibility of an illness, maybe. But that still doesn't prove that there's this particle called a virus, which is the agent of transmission. And frankly, if you don't understand that by now, then I don't know what to say. And to use an example of, well, how do you explain that if you get bitten by a rabid dog, you get rabies? Doesn't that prove the existence of a rabies virus? That's like saying, I threw the bucket of stones with a ping pong ball in it, except there is no ping pong ball, and it broke down the wall, and that proves ping pong balls break down the wall. If you haven't figured out the logical fallacy of that by now, I just really don't know what else to say. Because in order to prove that it's a virus, obviously you first have to show there is a virus, a particle that you could call a virus, in the saliva of a dog. Otherwise, how do you know it's a virus? And in fact, having looked exactly for that, show me a study showing this uniform morphology particle in the saliva of a rabid animal, there is no such study, period. And the doctor didn't know whether there is a study or not. He's apparently not interested in whether there is, or doesn't even know that one would even look. the evidence that the person got sick apparently is enough to say it's a virus. I don't even know what to say about that. So that was the main thing. And all this using epidemiological observations. Well, how do you explain people getting chickenpox? Or how do you explain people getting sick? I've been through that, I don't know how many times. It's what any non-professional knows by now, that in order to prove the existence of something, you have to, that you can't experience on your own, right? You can't see it, you can't feel it, you can't smell it. If we're talking about a particle, you have to find the particle, characterize it, separate it, show that that was the only possible agent. And if you're not willing to think like that, then you're not part of the conversation. Period. Is it true that these electron microscope images are actually coronaviruses? So first thing, these are computer-generated images, none of which are real. And you, if you use these to show that you found a coronavirus, then obviously if you find a picture of a unicorn, that proves it's unicorns exist. So we are not talking about these images. We're talking about this image or these images or this image or all this one with the arrow, this one. Now, the first thing to say is every image on an electron microscope slide is an artifact. An artifact just means it doesn't represent what that structure actually looked like in real life. Now, I would admit it doesn't prove that it exists or it doesn't exist, but it simply means that thing you're looking at is not what it looks like in real life. And it may have been created by the process of making the picture. So what is the process of making the picture? The process is first removing whatever fluid it is or tissue from its living matrix. That has a profound effect. And the whole point of science is if you do something like that, somehow you have to do a control to know that what you're looking at is not because you just killed it, but because it was there anyways. Now, sometimes that's even maybe impossible to do, so you have to try to figure it out some other way. But if you can't do it, you need to be clear that you're actually making suppositions which may not be true, and you may have to figure that out some other way. The next thing is they soak it in alcohol to dehydrate it, glutaraldehyde. They then sometimes, if it's transmission, they freeze it to ungodly temperatures below zero. They mix it with heavy metal stains. They shoot an electron beam at it. All of these things and more have profound impacts on what you're seeing, even to the fact of creating things which simply weren't there in, quote, real life. And they're just gas bubbles or heavy metal debris that's being stained. And every step of that way, you have to control to make sure you haven't diluted yourself. And somehow in modern science, otherwise known as delusional science, delusional anti-science, they've stopped doing these controls and they just assume that even though you soak something in glutaraldehyde and alcohol and transmission freeze it at not negative whatever, and then shoot an electron beam, somehow that doesn't change what you're looking at or even take actual living tissue and create something that simply wasn't there before or not in any way that you think. That is a profoundly anti-scientific conclusion. And what Mike did is prove by using peer-reviewed studies, so their own research that they know this. So what do I mean by that? So you can go down to this quote here. So this is from a paper. You can see it here. Here's the paper of this quote, number one. You can get to that in the, and then 5 through 7. So you look in the bibliography and you can see we are concerned about the erroneous identification of coronavirus directly in tissues by authors using electron microscopy. Most describe particles that resemble but do not have the appearance of coronavirus. Now, the first thing that's interesting is how do they know anything is coronavirus since this is the only way they can see them? But apart from that, so they're saying, you guys got to be careful because you look and you see these particles and they may look like it, but they're not coronaviruses. So here's an article by Farkash, number 8. You can go look at the reference. They, in his electron microscope images, do not demonstrate coronaviruses. Rather, these structures described as viruses, which, by the way, are used as proof that the virus exists, are clathrin, that's a protein from human beings, coated vesicles, CCVs, that are normal subcellular organelles involved in intracellular transport. In other words, as I've been saying all along, these are not viruses. These are just intracellular or intratissue debris that's being stained and it's being broken down, and that's all you're seeing. Then they refer to another article by Sue et al. That says, likewise, that article shows only normal cell structures that to a non-electron microscopist virologist may resemble coronavirus. I would actually say that even to a virologist, they may resemble what they think is coronavirus, but it's simply a delusion. Care should be taken to prevent mistaking cell organelles for viral particles, because identification of viruses, it turns out, is not always straightforward. So when you see nonsense like this and you say, how do you know that's not just heavy metal staining as opposed to this? And, or are you saying that this structure is the same as this? They don't look the same to me. And this one is the same as this one? Why do they look so different? And this one is a coronavirus? It's the same being as this? As this, as this. And so you can see these are multivesicular bodies cleverly, I put that word in, mimicking SARS-CoV-2 in patients without COVID. Who would have thought? Most of the published images depicting the suspected virus are similar, if not identical, to multivesicular bodies. In other words, they're just debris, exactly as I've been saying all along. This is garbage. Finally, we suspect that the electron microscope images of SARS-CoV-2 published to date are in fact MVBs, multivesicular bodies, otherwise known as cellular debris, because you've poisoned it, stained it, froze it, glued or aldehyde it, alcoholed it, shot it with an electron beam. And then we go on. MVBs theoretically may resent endocytosis, with et cetera. Those are just different kind of microvesicles. We do not know how or when they evolved or how long they remain. We don't know it. We have no idea what these things are. These are free-floating cytoplasmic microvesicles, but they are nonspecific. They have the presence of coding proteins, which causes an electron-dense area around these vesicles giving the appearance of a viral corona. Who would have thought that famous corona turns out not to be a corona of a virus at all, just a bunch of stained proteins dotting the outside of cellular garbage. Then the famous transmission electron microscope. Well, we didn't stain it. We just froze it. And of course, we all know that if you freeze something to minus whatever, it looks exactly like it would in real life. I know, because I froze Grandpa, cryopreserved him, and I couldn't tell the difference between Grandpa frozen and Grandpa not frozen. And if that's your experience, you need to have a better view of life, because to any normal person, Grandpa frozen does not look like Grandpa not frozen. No living thing looks like it does, frozen and unfrozen. And you create all kinds of new particles when you freeze something to those temperatures. And so they say, quote, transmission electron microscopy of tissue sections is not a specific or sensitive method for the detection of viral particles. What? You mean the exact method they use to say that is a viral particle? It turns out in the peer-reviewed literature is neither sensitive nor specific. There are numerous structures found by electron microscopy that resemble viruses, so-called viral-like particles. They go on to say some. Therefore, caution is suggested when identifying viruses by electron microscopy in tissue sections. I would go so far as say, forget about caution, you can't do it. And for those who want to see the method and the whole article, there it is. Multivesicular bodies or SARS-CoV-2. And we read with interest the correspondence by so-and-so and colleagues, possible infection of endothelial cells by SARS-CoV-2 using electron microscopy image as evidence. However, we believe the EM images in the correspondence do not show coronavirus particles, but instead show cross-sections of rough endoplasmic reticulum, even though it turns out there is no such thing as rough endoplasmic reticulum. That is simply another artifact of dead and dying cells. But never mind, you can't tell this artifact from that artifact. And that, you know, those spherical structures with the black dots? These guys? Well, it turns out those are instead maybe imaginary ribosomes. But we interpreted them as spikes on the coronavirus. A ribosome is what you get when you just dehydrate the tissue, and it creates gas bubbles which stick to the created images called endoplasmic reticulum. You mix them together and you get spikes on viruses, which is no such thing because they made it up. And here's a final thing from The Lancet, which we found structures which are normally can be found in the cytoplasm, and they have been misinterpreted as viruses. Electron microscopy can be a powerful tool, but care must be taken when interpreting cytoplasmic structures to correctly identify them. They, of course, don't say what care, because there is no care. There is no way they can distinguish between the two, because the whole thing is simply a bunch of hooey. Here's the fact which every virologist agrees to, and I can even explain that a little bit. There is not one published scientific paper where any particle that you could call a virus, and remember, a virus is a thing, it's a particle, we can sort of see it under an electron microscope, even though that's problematic. But so this thing, they tell us, there's not one published paper in the scientific literature finding this thing in any biological fluid of any sick human or animal, anywhere. And everybody agrees. All the virologists agree. They say that's not how you find a virus. That all that we have 150 like institutions, the NIH and the CDC, et cetera. We ask them, can you show us a paper finding this particle in a bio, in any fluid of any sick person? And they say, we don't have such a paper.
Claim they don't have an isolate, but they...
No, they claim they cannot find the virus in any fluid. Now, even though they say there's a reason for that, because that's not how they do it. But just think back to the termites. There are no termites there.
Right.
There's no virus. Even though they say you have to grow it in a culture. Now, here's the first question. Since the viral theory is I breathe in this virus, it uses my lungs as a culture, right? And so then it grows, and then it's teeming with viruses that get spewed out in the world. Why can't you find it in your lungs? It's a culture.
Oh, your point is if you do a direct electron microscopy of the fluid, you won't see this.
Never.
Okay. Yeah. I see.
Never. Not once. We asked a guy who was 20 years, senior virologist at Wuhan Institute of Virology, 20 years head of Yale Virology Laboratory. Can you find SARS-CoV-2 in any fluid of any person you say has COVID? He said no. Why not? Because there's not enough virus to find. Okay, we asked him, what about if you put 10 people with supposed COVID and you mix their bronchial fluid together? Is there enough? No. 100 people? No. 1,000 people? No, not enough to see. 10,000 people? You mix their fluid together. Would you then have enough virus to see? And he said no, and then he wouldn't answer anymore. There is no virus to see in your lungs,
right,
or in your snot.
Enough that they'll admit.
Anywhere.
Yeah.
So just like the termites. So what do? You take the snot and you don't purify it. You don't find anything. You mix that with fetal calf serum. Right, and then you spread it on monkey kidney cells.
Yeah,
and then you take away the nutrients, and then you add amphotericin, which is a kidney poison, and gentamicin, which is a kidney poison. And then what happens? The kidney cells break down into millions of particles, and they say that proves the virus exists.
Yeah, okay.
Now, think about that. That's exactly, I took wood, I didn't find any termites, I put it in termite egg solution, and then I made it grow, and then I found termites. Now, I could show you this if you want, but it's in the book. We did the experiment again. So we took, we started with nothing from any sick person. We took the monkey kidney cells, right? We added fetal calf serum, just like same amount they do, took away the nutrients, added amphotericin, and you know what happened? It broke down. And it created electron microscopy images that are indistinguishable from SARS-CoV-2.
Right.
But remember, there was no SARS-CoV-2. There was no fluid.
No inoculant.
Anybody.
Right.
So that proves that the breakdown of the tissue, which is not a proof, right? It is the proof that the virus exists and causes disease, is a fraud.
Yeah.
Because it's a result of the experimental process. Now, I can read you, 50 peer-reviewed studies showing, like here, I have one here, electron microscopy, quote, we are concerned about the erroneous identification of coronavirus directly in tissues using electron microscopy because they describe particles that resemble but do not have the appearance of coronavirus. There's at least 50 studies saying nobody can tell the difference between multi-vesicular breakdown in exosomes and debris versus this so-called virus.
Right.
Now, interestingly, the guy from Australia who identified it first, and I can practically quote it off the top of my head, said, well, we did this culture and we found these particles, but they didn't look like coronavirus. So we added trypsin.
Yeah.
And then it looked like a coronavirus.
Right.
And that's like, I go to my barn and I was looking for chickens and all I found was cats. So I taped some feathers on them and look, there's a chicken.
Yeah.
This is nonsense.
Yeah.
Then they say they find the genome. And I can, again, read you 20 papers. Anytime you put fetal calf serum in there that contaminates the specimen, you cannot find the genome. You don't know whether this is coming from the kidneys, from the original unpurified snot, from the fetal calf serum. They put it all in a thing. They put it through like a puzzle maker. It's called alignment.
Yeah.
And create the genome, which never exists in this solution. The reason I say the termite thing is because the people you should be skeptical of is a termite company that, by the way, sells you termite killing powder, which everybody should spray on their house. They're the ones who say, I have a way of finding the termites. Well, you better be real sure that every step of that process is actually scientific and controlled, because I can tell you it's frank nonsense.
What's amazing to me is that people buy into the fact that they show this genome. This looks really sciencey and all that. And it's all these, you know, bases listed like a huge 30,000 base pair genome, because it's from a computer. And they say, look, of course we've isolated it. There's the genome. I, even an orthopedic surgeon could figure out the BS there. I mean, it's just, and they call it an in silico genome. My favorite is in Prashant Pradhan's paper that when they're showing the inserts that were put into the spike protein, they call it the consensus genome. That's how they label it. It's consensus.
And for people who want to think, how does this come about? Here's how it works. Imagine you have a puzzle, right? And you put 56 million puzzle pieces. So I'm going to use you as a foil again. And I say to you, Lee, make the correct puzzle, right? And do you have any questions for me?
But we don't know the size and we don't have a picture.
You don't have a picture. Make the puzzle. You got any questions?
I use that same metaphor.
You can't do it.
Right.
So what do you do? Well, first of all, they say, I'll give you $1 million if you make the picture of the bridge. Which bridge? Not going to tell you. Okay, so you say, well, give me $1 million, I'll start looking. So you find some struts, right? You say, these must be part of the bridge, right? Because we know about struts. And then they give you a prize for finding the strut protein, otherwise known as the spike protein.
Yeah.
And then everybody makes a little bit different bridge, because there is no bridge. So everybody has their own version, which is why we have 7 million variants. And everybody argues, like measles, they've been at this for 70 years. And nobody has the right genome or the right picture, because you can't do it if you don't have the picture of the bridge. If you did, and you have, because you have every possible nucleotide sequence to work with, so you can make whatever you want. Now, once they make one, then they use that as the template to make the other ones, so it looks like that. Because once you make one unicorn and you say people make another unicorn, they make it sort of like the old unicorn.
Right. The SARS-CoV-1 unicorn just happened to be about 30,000 base pairs. So we'll look for something that's about 30,000 base pairs and happens to look like SARS-CoV-1.
Right.
I went back and read the paper. Right. I couldn't believe it.
Yeah, and then that one was made against the bat one in 1996, and that was against the hamster one in 1984, and that was against the bear one in 1906, and that one was made up.
And even more sinister than that is the way that that then became a vaccine. The drug companies then took this in silico genetic sequence from the internet that the Chinese had uploaded from one patient, and ba-boom, they overnight made a vaccine. That's what they admit to. That's what they say. That's what Fauci says. We got this within hours. Once they uploaded the sequence, we took it and made a vaccine.
Right.
Unbelievable. If people knew what they were being, you know, given based on one patient and this uploaded genetic sequence on the computer, it's unbelievable.
Yeah, it's complete make-believe.
Yeah.
It is just flat out. Virology is, you know, because in this study that we did, we actually took this culture, right? So it broke down, and then it breaks down in all these pieces, and then we did an alignment. Right? We found the genome.
You did like they did. Okay.
Yeah, we did like they did. And we found SARS-CoV-2. But we can also find any other RNA virus as long as you put yeast RNA in there. So you just sprinkle some yeast in there, and then you get HIV and Ebola and measles and SARS-CoV-2, because it's partly, once you start with all the RNA sequences, but also the PCR process makes de novo sequences. They make sequences which weren't there. The reason you know that is because if you do 10 cycles, you can only get 10% of the genome. If you do 40 cycles, you get 98% of the genome, which means that approximately 80% were made by the process, this is crazy, and yet we all believe it.
Well, many people realize the world got shut down because of this kind of fraud?
Yeah.
I mean, that's really the sad part, is we shut the world down and killed a bunch of people over this fraud.
Yes, exactly. Yeah,
that is really sad.
That's
sad.
I was introduced to the work of a guy named Harold Hillman. I don't know if you know Harold Hillman, but he was the best biologist who ever lived. He dedicated himself to saying, you know, unless we really prove that this is true, I'm not going to believe it. So let me give you an example, because he ended up saying everything you see in an electron microscope is an artifact. Because after all, you take a living tissue, you kill it, soak it in alcohol, soak it in glutaraldehyde, freeze it to minus whatever, 80, stain it with heavy metal or transmission with these, and that picture you get has no resemblance with what happens at a living being. None. And that's the only way we've seen viruses. That's also the only way we've seen something called a ribosome.
Right.
Right? So a ribosome, and here's the things that Hillman, I would say, and I'll use this word judiciously, demonstrated, maybe proved, don't exist. Lipid bilayer membranes, synapses in nerves, endoplasmic reticulum, ribosomes, Golgi apparatus, sodium potassium pump, protein receptors in cell membranes. And there's about 20 other ones. Now, I guarantee if you read Hillman and you read it with an open mind, and I'll give you an example, you will also agree. So let me talk about ribosomes. First of all, ribosomes are very important to this current problem, because that's where mRNA is translated, made into proteins, in the cytoplasm. That's what we're told. And without ribosomes, there's no place for these proteins to be made. And the reason this is so important is we are living proteins, right? Proteins in water and minerals, that's what a human being on a physical level. So it's important to the The whole genetic theory is DNA makes RNA makes protein, and that's made in the ribosomes. So he goes and traces the whole history of ribosomes from the initial discovery. And one of the things, and there's a whole lot to this, but I'll just be brief. One of the things he found is that every single picture of a ribosome is a perfect sphere. Perfect sphere. Now, remember that the only way you saw it is you took some tissue, put it in a blender, froze it, stained it, dehydrated it, poisoned it, etc., cut it up into little pieces. So I ask you, if you have an orange, that's a perfect sphere, and what you see on a picture is a circle, right? Because that's what a sphere is. What are the chances, if you put it in a blender, that every piece of that orange would be a perfect circle?
Right.
The answer is zero. And so what is it? It's a stained gas bubble. Which means there is no place we know of where the mRNA is made into protein. And maybe that's not even the way it works. Now, here's to show another side of this. Once we see that this entire edifice of modern biology, from at least the time of Virchow in the 1850s, is basically nonsense. It's an artifact. It's a materialistic, make-believe story. Then you see that there is another story, which is living beings are electromagnetic fields being downloaded by the receiver, which is water. Once you see the game, once you see that this is the whole, you know, medicine, biology, it's all based on make-believe science.
Because a lot of times when I say to people, well, how do you know this is a virus? And then the first thing they say to me usually is, well, what else could it be? And I would contend that by definition, in a way, that is the wrong question. And let me give you another example of that. Again, let's say you go to Lubbock, Texas, and every morning at 8 o'clock, you run around the track maybe six times, and the inside of the track is a football field like most tracks are, and the football field is made of grass. And every day you run around the track, and that's fine. And then one morning you go there at 8, and there's a 5-story boulder in the middle of the grassy field that covers about half of the track. But underneath that boulder, the grass is perfectly normal, perfectly normal. And then you go home and think, man, I don't know what happened there. I don't know how that boulder got there. And then you hear on the news in Lubbock, Texas, and I don't mean to pick on Lubbock, Texas, but a boulder fell from the sky. It's probably a meteor and landed in Lubbock, in the football field in Lubbock, Texas. And I think most of us would say to yourself, hey, wait a minute. If a thing like that fell from the sky, like a meteor, I would expect there to be a hole or a crater or the grass would be messed up or something. But in fact, there was nothing like that. And so I think you would be skeptical of the explanation. And then if somebody said, so what did happen? And you might say, I don't know. I wasn't there. Maybe somebody put it there with a forklift. Or maybe the fairies dropped it there and they did it very carefully. Or I don't know what happened, but I know that what you're saying is supposedly happened, that didn't happen. And the reason I say that now is because the first part of this, I hope I explained the fact that we should all at least be skeptical, if not actually look into how do you prove a virus exists. And did the people running this actually prove that?